just past the top of the hour here on KPFA. My name is Brian Edwards. You're normally on the air live at 7 o'clock in the morning. But this hour, as we try to help KPFA towards meeting the fundraising goals, we need to keep the good work going. We're going to bring you one of our favorite recent interviews that we did. Speaking to Johan Hari about his new book, Stolen Focus. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Upfront.
I'm Brian Edwards, teacher. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Johan Hari, who spent a lot of the last decade trying to bring social context to things we're encouraged to treat as individual failings. Addiction, depression, and now distraction. Some of the world's most powerful companies are basically devoted to monopolizing as much of our attention as they can. But instead of talking about the implications of their business models, we seem to mostly pass around things like short tip lists for how to maintain the focus that they have legions of behavioral scientists and software engineers working on resting away. Johan Hari, it's always a pleasure to speak to you. The new book is Stolen Focus, Why You Can't Pay Attention. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Brian. It's always great to be with you.
Tell me how you got started on this topic.
You know, it started for quite a personal reason. I noticed that with each year that passed, my ability to focus was getting worse. And it felt like things that required deep focus, that are very deep to myself, like reading a book, watching long movies, were getting more and more like running up and down escalators. You know what I mean? Like, I still do them, but they were getting harder and harder. And I noticed this happening to pretty much everyone I knew. And I was particularly worried about the young people in my life who often seem to be kind of whirring at the speed of Snapchat when nothing still or serious could touch them. But for a long time, I kind of thought, isn't this just a perennial human problem? Doesn't every generation struggle with attention? But when I started to research this, I was quite struck by what I learned. For every one child who was identified as having serious attention problems when I was seven years old, there's now 100 children who have been identified with that problem. The average American office worker now focuses on any one task for only three minutes. And I learned all this, I thought, I'm trying to figure out what's happening to us here. So I ended up going on a big journey all over the world from Miami to Melbourne to Moscow to Montreal, not just to see some of the 11 M's, and I interviewed over 200 of the leading experts in the world about focus and attention. I used my training in social sciences at Cambridge University to really delve deeply into their research. And what I learned is there's scientific evidence of 12 factors that can make your attention better or can make it worse.
And loads of the factors that can make your attention worse have been hugely increasing in recent years. And this is really important because it means if you're struggling to focus, if you're struggling to pay attention, don't blame yourself. This is happening to almost all of us. There are solutions, but we have to understand this problem differently. You have to understand that your attention didn't collapse. Your attention has been stolen from you. So I always try to reality check things that might be moral panics.
I know sometimes diagnoses in children go up, not because there's more widespread illness in children, but because we've gotten more sensitive to the thing we're trying to diagnose. So I'm always asking myself when I struggle with something like paying attention, is this just a function of being in my 40s and having the brain of a 20-something, or a function of having more responsibilities in life than I did at an earlier point? So at a very bird's eye view, what's the kind of raw data that we have had a broad social scale degradation in our attention spans? So there's two ways that we can be confident there's an attention crisis.
The first way would have been, if for the last hundred years, scientists had consistently given people the same kind of attention test every year. That wasn't done, that data wasn't gathered, we won't be able to tell from that kind of method. But there's a different method that I think we can reasonably draw conclusions from. So there are
lots of factors that have been shown in small experiments in sociology to really damage your attention, and there's lots of evidence that many of them be hugely critical. Let's be really obvious examples. We sleep 20% less than we did in a century ago, according to the National Sleep Foundation. In fact, children sleep 85 minutes less than we did a century ago. And I interviewed lots of the leading sleep experts in the world, and they explained to me the scientific evidence is overwhelming. If you don't sleep, your attention gets much worse. In fact, if you stay awake for just 19 hours, which doesn't seem like very much, your attention deteriorates to the same level as if you've got legally drunk.
And there was one piece of science about this, of many other times on sleep, that really drove this home to me. A wonderful man named Dr. Charles Seisler, who's arguably the leading sleep expert in the world, he's at Harvard Medical School. He put together two forms of technology that hadn't been put together in sleep research before. There's a technology that can scan your eyes to see what you're looking at, and there's a technology that you'll know about that can scan your brain to see what's happening there. And he put tired people into this machinery, and what he discovered is, and they didn't even have to be that tired. You can appear to be awake, you can be looking around you, but whole parts of your brain can have gone to sleep. This is called local sleep. So when we say we feel half asleep, turns out that's not a metaphor. We often are literally half asleep in our culture. And Dr. Seisler said to me, Even if nothing else had changed, even if the only thing that had changed is that we sleep 20% less than we used to, that alone would be causing a huge attention crisis, because when you're sleeping, your brain is repairing, it's healing itself, and we're denying our brain's and our children's brains that space to heal. And of course, that's not the only change that's happened. There's many changes like that for which we have very good evidence in the short and medium term that they cause attention problems, and very good evidence that they have increased. I think what you said about moral panic is, you know, something I really reckon with in the book, because I thought that way for a long time. And the people who don't know about moral panic, there's a very strong sociology. You know, a classic example would be in the 1950s, loads of kids started reading what the time of regard is very violent comic books, and there's a big panic about it, that God's going to make kids really violent. Or think about the 90s, you remember this, Brian, there's a huge panic about rap music, that teenagers listen to rap music, it's going to make people violent. You know, and now we regard, you know, Jay-Z is a great artist and kids really read comics as very kind of an innocuous. But there's a different historical analogy, I think, that when we look at the evidence, it's much better with what's happening to our attention. And a really explodes a lot with Esther Joel Nagy, one of the leading experts on children's attention problems in the world, going to be reported in Oregon. And that analogy is the obesity crisis. If you look at a picture of a beach in the United States in 1970, it's kind of weird when you look at it now, because everyone is what we would call slim or buff. Everyone. The first thing that weighs everyone else, but then you look at the figures, and then there was almost no obesity in 1970, 1970, 1970, 1970, 1970,
from eating mostly fresh and nutritious food to mostly processed and unhealthy food. And we built cities that it's basically impossible to walk and bike around, and we became much more stressed, which made us come eat more. And these big changes produced an obesity crisis. Now, if you go back to the early stages of the obesity crisis, there were lots of people who said, oh, this is just a moral panic. How can you say that people are going to be, you're going to have a situation where half the population is obese? It's ridiculous. And I think when you look at the evidence, as Professor Nick said to me, we need to ask if we're now living in what you call an intentional pathogenic environment. One in which it's going to get increasingly difficult for all of us to pay attention. And that requires a different set of solutions. Because at the moment, we're basically responding the way we responded to the obesity crisis. The obesity crisis was a social crisis. And we responded by blaming ourselves, by torturing ourselves, by trying to just eat less, and it completely failed, as we all know. My worry is, to now, we've been responding to the attention crisis in a similar way. We've been giving people digital diet books, we've been giving them tips on minor changes, and I'm passionate in favour of individual changes. I've made lots of them myself. I talk about them in the book. But they're not going to get us there. We've got to also deal with the bigger factors that are doing this to us. Because at the moment, It's like someone is pouring itching powder over us all day, and then they're leaning over and going, hey, buddy, you might want to learn how to meditate. Then you wouldn't scratch so much. And it's like, I'll learn to meditate, but we need to stop you from pouring itching powder on us. And a big part of my book, Stolen Focus, is about how we can do that in a very practical way.
Well, let's talk about the broader internal environment, because it is a much bigger issue than people just sleeping less. What are the challenges facing most of us on a regular basis?
So I'll give you an example of one that everyone will be experiencing today, and probably while they're listening to this show. I went to interview a man named Professor Earl Miller, who's one of the leading neuroscientists in the world. He's at MIT. And he said to me, look, there's one thing you need to understand about the human brain more than anything else. You can only consciously think about one or two things at a time. That's it. This is a fundamental limitation of the human brain. The human brain has not significantly changed in 40,000 years, so it's not going to change on any timescale. You can only think about one or two things at a time.
But what's happened is we've fallen from mass delusion.
The average American teenager now believes they can follow six or seven forms of media at the same time. So what happens is scientists get people into labs, teens and adults, and they get them to think they're doing lots of things at the same time. And what they discovered is, in fact, you can't do more than one thing at a time. What you do is you very rapidly juggle between your tasks.
You're like, wait, what did that person just say on WhatsApp? What did Brian just ask me?
What's that message on Facebook? What does it say on the TV over there? You're constantly juggling. And it turns out this juggling comes with a huge cost. The technical term for it is the switch cost effect. Everyone needs to understand the switch cost effect. It's very simple. When you try and do more than one thing at a time, you will do all the things you're trying to do less competently. You'll make more mistakes, you'll be less creative. You'll remember less of what you do, and it feels like a small effect, right? But actually, when you look at the evidence, it's pretty huge. I'll give you an example of a small study backed by a much wider body of evidence that was one of the ones that really drove home for me. The printer company, Hewlett-Packard, got scientists in to study their workers, and he split them into two groups. The first group was told, just get on with your task, whatever it is, and you won't be interrupted. And the second group was told, get on with your task, whatever it is, but you're going to have to answer a heavy load of email and phone calls. So pretty much how most of us live most of the time. At the end of the experiment, they tested the IQs of both groups. And the group that had not been interrupted scored 10 IQ points higher than the group who had. To give you a sense of how big that effect is, if you and me sat down together now, Brian, and we smoked fast spliff together, our IQs would go down in the short term by five points. So being distracted is twice as bad for your intelligence as getting stoned. This suggests you'd be better off sitting at your desk, getting stoned, and doing one thing at a time, than sitting at your desk, not getting stoned, and trying to do lots of things at a time. This is why Professor Miller says we're currently living in what he calls a perfect storm of cognitive degradation as a result of all these interruptions. And these interruptions can be small things we don't even think of as interruptions. A man named Professor Michael Posner at the University of Oregon discovered that if you're interrupted, it takes you on average 23 minutes to get back to the same level of focus that you had before you were interrupted. But many of us never go 23 minutes without being interrupted. So we're constantly operating at this profoundly diminished level of brain power. A different study found that if you receive eight text messages an hour, it diminishes your brain power and your ability to absorb information by 30%. That's a staggering amount of brain power for us all to be losing throughout the day.
So when we talk about interruptions, you're basically describing... Everything that happens on the tip of mobile device most of us carry around in our pockets. The bombardment of buzzes, chimes, notifications, hey, look at this thing, not the thing you currently have on the screen. Or hey, look at the screen, not the thing you're engaging with in front of you.
Exactly. And it's important to understand, and one thing that interested me actually in the research that's done on focus, and really surprised me, is that actually, when I started, I basically thought the reason I can focus was for two reasons. I thought I was personally lacking in willpower, and I thought, well, the reason is someone invented a smartphone. Actually, when I looked at all the science, there's components in our tech that are embedding our attention that are a huge factor, but they're only one of the 12 factors that I write about in the book. Interestingly, I don't think they're the biggest, although they're hugely important things, I'm sure we'll come to some of the others. But you're absolutely right. The technology we currently use is frequently designed to maximally interrupt us. And it's important to understand this technology doesn't have to work this way. We can have all the technology we currently have without it being designed to maximally interrupt us. And to understand why it's designed to maximally interrupt us, you've got to understand something I learned in your neck of the woods being lots of people in Silicon Valley, which is, and it's very simple, and most of your listeners will know this,
but The business model for almost all currencies in social media is very simple.
The more often you pick up the app, and the longer you scroll, the more money you make. That's their business model.
Just like KFC want you to eat fried chicken,
the social media companies want you to scroll as often and as long as possible.
And this is absolutely inherent to their business model.
So all of their engineering power... All of their algorithmic genius is geared towards one thing, figuring out how do we get Brian to pick up his phone more often and scroll longer?
How do we get his kids to pick up their phones and scroll longer?
But social media doesn't have to work this way.
And there's a historical analogy that really helped me to understand what we can do about this.
There are lots of things we can do as individuals to protect ourselves.
And we've got to have two levels of response. We've got to play defense by protecting ourselves and our kids at an individual level as much as possible.
Happy to talk about many of the techniques I use to do that.
But we've also got to go on offense.
We've got to take on the factors that are doing this to us.
And there's a historical analogy that really helped me to think about this.
So you'll remember, Brian, we're the same age.
It used to be the standard form of gasoline in the United States.
Was leaded gasoline.
So you put leaded gasoline in your car, and there was a huge amount of lead in the air through air pollution.
Also used to be normal. People would paint their homes with leaded paint.
And it turned out exposure to lead is extremely bad for people's brains, and it is particularly bad
for children's ability to focus and pay attention.
So by the 1970s, this science was completely unambiguous.
So groups of ordinary moms, it was overwhelmingly moms, banded together and said, why are we allowing this?
Why are we allowing these companies to poison our children's brains and ruin their ability to focus?
And so they formed a movement.
And it's really important to look at what their movement didn't say.
They didn't say, let's ban all paint.
They didn't say, let's ban all gasoline.
What they said is, let's ban the specific aspects in the paint and in the gasoline that are damaging people's focus and attention.
And they fought for years, and they succeeded.
Lead has been banned.
Our exposure to lead has enormously gone down. It hasn't entirely eradicated. There's still quite a lot of lead pipes.
And unfortunately, the plans to remove those lead pipes in the Build Back Better program were taken out.
You can all thank Joe Manchin for that.
So we are still exposed to some lead,
but it's nothing like as much as it used to be.
And that has led to all sorts of improvements.
Now, there's a tight analogy, I think, with social media.
So when I interviewed, for example, Asa Raskin, who invented a key part of how the internet works,
something called infinite scroll, his dad, Jeff Raskin, invented the Apple Macintosh, Steve Jobs.
Asa said to me, look, if you want to deal with the tech component that's damaging our attention,
we've got to do this very simple.
You've got to ban the current business model.
You've got to say business model is premised on figuring out the weaknesses in your attention.
Hacking them and selling your attention to the highest bidder is just fundamentally inhuman and immoral.
It's like lead in paint, and we should not allow it.
I remember saying to Asa and lots of other people who said this to me, and these are people who've been at the heart of the machinery that is obsessing us and our kids.
I said to them, okay, but let's imagine we do this, we ban this business model. What would happen the next day when I open Facebook?
Would it say, sorry guys, we've gone fishing?
And he said, of course not.
What happens is they have to move to a different business model.
And everyone listening has an experience of what those two different business models are.
One is subscription.
We all know how Netflix and HBO work.
We pay a small amount in return to get access.
The other, think about the sewers.
Before we had sewers, we had feces in the street.
We got cholera.
So we all pay to build the sewers together and maintain them.
And we all own the sewers.
You own the sewers in Berkeley.
And we all own the sewers, right? Together.
It may be that we want to own the sewage pipes together, We want to align the information pipes together because we're getting the equivalent cholera for our attention by individual and our collective attention. But the key thing about this is that once you move to this different business model, the incentives completely change. At the moment, you're not the customer for these companies.
You are the product they sell to the real customers, the advertisers. They have your attention to sell it to advertisers.
But under these different business models, suddenly you become the customer and they have to say, not how do we get Brian to scroll the maximum amount of time, but what does Brian want? Brian wants to be able to meet up with his friends offline.
Let's make it really easy for the app to facilitate that. Brian wants to be able to pay attention.
Let's design it to do that.
That's completely technically feasible, easily to do. But just like the lead industry wasn't going to one day just go, you know what, guys, I think we've made enough money. I think we should stop doing this now. They had to be made to do it by movement.
We have to do this. Part of our argument, our focus is that just like we needed and still need a feminist movement to reclaim women's bodies and lives, we need to have an attention movement to reclaim our minds.
And it requires a shift in consciousness.
We are not medieval peasants begging at the court of King Zuckerberg for a few little crumbs of attention from his table.
We are the free citizens of democracies, and we own our own minds. And we can take them back from the forces that have stolen them.
The voice of Johann Hari. His brand new book is Stolen Focus. Why You Can't Pay Attention and How to Think Deeply Again.
And it's not the first book to come out that's trying to engage with the phenomenon of the incredible shrinking attention span.
But it's the first book to really do two things at once. Which is talking about what is going on for us individually, and what we can hopefully control, like how many interruptions are resting our attention away from the things we're trying to focus on, or how much sleep we get at night, or what kind of food we're putting into our bodies. But he also focuses on our social conditions and the conditions that beg for a social solution, a political solution, a policy remedy, a collective action, which really means, in this day and age, confronting the power of big tech. It is at once both incredibly useful and politically powerful,
and written incredibly accessibly.
He takes you through his journey to talk with researchers on the cutting edge of neurology, psychology, the science that is emerging around the human attention span, insights from his own life and journeys, and his own experiments with trying to do things to make it possible for him to focus more on the people and things and activities that matter most to him. He takes you through the effects of our speed-ups and multitasking at the workplace, the constant interruptions imposed by our devices, the exhaustion that sets in physically and mentally as the average night's sleep has shrunk steadily. The collapse of the kind of attention training that is the product of deep reading, what happens when you settle down with a book and nothing but a book, popping up notifications. The collapse of mind wandering when there is an app and a platform and a distraction to fill up every minute interstitial piece of attention between every other activity. And most importantly, he takes you through what tools you can put to work in your own life to recover some of that attention, some of that space from mind wandering.
The ones that have worked for him, the ones that have tried but couldn't work for you.
He's frank about his own failings and weaknesses. And the bigger political fights.
All of which is to say, we would love to share a copy of this book with you.
One of his insights is that reading an actual book on paper is a great way to train up your own attention span.
And if you pledge for it right now, you'll both be supporting KPFA and supporting the publishing world that nurtures those great fortifiers of our collective attention.
The book is Johann Hari's Stolen Focus, Why You Can't Pay Attention and How to Think Deeply Again. And it is yours for a pledge of $150 or more at 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or kpfa.org.
I've spoken long enough.
Any amount you pledge will help us out.
There is one other piece of news on that front that I probably shouldn't have waited this long to put out there.
One of your fellow listeners, Arcelia in Santa Rosa, is offering to double $1,000 if we can raise $1,000 to match her by the end of the hour,
which is 34 minutes from now.
I'm going to be bringing you more interview with Johan Hari for most of those 34 minutes. So we're hoping that some of your pledge at the interview continues.
Right now, every single phone line is free.
The book is yours for a pledge of $15 a month.
Or $150 all at once.
1-800-439-5732
or kpfa.org.
The $1,000 countdown starts now.
And we're going back to the conversation with Johan Hari.
All the algorithms are designed to maximize the amount of time you spend scrolling. So they're constantly looking for what kind of words, what kind of phrases keep people scrolling.
And although this wasn't the intention of anyone on Facebook or Twitter or TikTok,
those algorithms discovered an underlying truth about human psychology that's actually been known about quite a long time, for more than 50 years.
It's called negativity bias.
Negativity bias is very easy to understand.
It's an underlying truth about human psychology.
You will stare longer at something that makes you angry or upset than you will at something that makes you feel good.
Anyone who's ever seen a car accident on the highway knows how that works.
You stared longer at the mangled car than you did at the pretty flowers on the other side of the street.
This is very deep human psychology.
10-week-old babies will stare longer at an angry face than a smiling face.
Probably for a very good reason in our evolution.
Our ancestors who were alert to anger and danger probably got to be our ancestors and the ones that were just staring at flowers didn't make it. When this combined with this particular business model, it leads to a catastrophic outcome, both individually and collectively.
So imagine two teenage girls who go to the same party and leave on the same bus.
And one of them does a status update that says, that was a really nice party. Everyone was really good.
I had a great time.
The other one does a status update where they say,
Karen was a total skank at that party.
I hate her boyfriend stinks.
Just go down a list of insults, right?
The algorithm is scanning everything that's posted.
And it'll pick up on the first one.
And it'll put it into a few people's feeds.
But it knows that words that are enraging, indignant, abusive,
Get much more engagement.
And so it'll pick that up and it'll put it into far more people's speech.
Because they know people reply, what do you mean, Karen's a skank?
You can see, now that's bad enough at the level of two teenage girls on a bus.
But that's happened to our whole society, right?
When the far right leader, Jair Bolsonaro, who had been a completely obscure, washed-up senator, was picked up by these algorithms, particularly on YouTube, massively promoted to the people of Brazil.
He became elected president. There's probably some parallels in history that everyone's been through right now.
And on the night he won the election, what did his supporters chant outside?
Facebook, because they knew one of the key reasons why he won.
So at the moment we're all living in a machinery as a result of this business model that is maximizing anger and rage. We're all seeing this horrific level of polarization to the point where we're now having speculation that we're going to have a civil war.
Now there's many factors that are driving that. I don't want to be naive about this. This is one of them.
The genocide in Burma, Myanmar, that took place a couple of years ago against the Rohingya Muslim majority was hugely supercharged by Facebook algorithms because it picked up on the angry hateful things that were said about the Rohingya and amplified to far more people's speeds, which motivated far more people to then go and act against the Rohingya.
These are really dangerous dynamics.
And it's true that there's a cost to taking them on, it's a big fight, but I would just say to people, what's the cost of not taking on these factors?
Individual attention is being destroyed.
That's bad enough, it's horrendous, but our collective attention is also being destroyed.
Our ability to hear each other, to think sanely, to take collective action, and that's happening at a time when we most need to take collective action.
When we're facing a whole series of unprecedented tripwires and trapdoors from COVID to climate crisis,
we've got to get our attention back.
I want to spend a few minutes kind of getting into stakes. What we lose when our attention gets fragmented.
Early in the book, you have a deep dive into a research topic called flow states.
What are they? What's happening to them?
So in terms of the biggest stakes, is a really simple, if you want to think about why this topic is so important, I would just say to anyone listening, Think about anything you've ever achieved in your life that you're proud of. Picture one thing now, whether it's starting a business, leading a campaign group, being a good parent, learning to play the guitar, whatever this thing you're proud of is, it took a lot of staying focused and attention. And when focus and attention break down, Your ability to solve your problems and achieve your goals also breaks down. And you become kind of stumped of yourself. You sense what you might have been if you've been able to apply yourself, but you feel like you can't get there.
And the one you talked about is a really good example.
So everyone listening will have experienced a flow state. A flow state is when you're doing something that's meaningful to you and you really get into it. And suddenly your sense of time falls away, your ego goes away, and you're just in it. The way Ron Climber described it is when you're in flow, it feels like you are the rock you're climbing.
Right? And we all have different things that get us into flow.
For me, it's writing. For you, it might be playing the guitar, running on the beach, brain surgery, making bagels. It could be a whole range of human things.
But I think there's very strong evidence that when we are constantly interrupted and jammed on, switching all the time, your ability to get into flow states hugely diminishes.
So to understand this, I went to Climb Mountain California to interview Professor Mahali, who was the leading expert on flow states, the guy who coined the phrase in the 60s, he studied them for over 50 years. And I think I did the last interview with him, he died soon afterwards. I want to understand, because flow is really important for the debate about attention, because flow is the deepest form of attention humans can provide, and it's the one where the attention feels the least difficult, right?
When you're in flow, it's not like trying to memorize facts for an exam, the attention comes really easily.
Flow is a gusher of attention that sits inside all of us. So I wanted to understand, and I suppose Professor Mahali's work very closely, how can we maximize our chances of getting into flow?
And I think there's three ways, there's lots to discover, but for me there are three key lessons.
The first is, to get into flow, you have to choose just one goal. You have to set aside all your other goals for a while and focus on one thing.
I want to paint this canvas, I want to write this article, whatever it might be.
If you're trying to do more than one thing at a time, you will not get into flow. Secondly, you've got to choose a goal that is meaningful to you.
Right? So your goal might be to paint a canvas, and try and paint a canvas that looks like a child has vomited on it.
I'm not going to get into flow doing that, it's not meaningful to me.
Your attention will slip aside to things that aren't meaningful to you.
Thirdly, it will hugely help if you choose a goal that is at the edge of your comfort zone.
Just something at the edge of your abilities.
So let's say you're a medium talent rock climber.
You don't want to just climb over your garden wall. That's not going to get you into flow.
It's going to be too easy.
Equally, you don't want to suddenly try and climb Kilimanjaro. That's going to be too much.
You want to climb a slightly higher and harder rock face than the one you tried last time.
So these three things.
Choose one goal. Choose a meaningful goal.
And ideally make it one at the edge of your abilities and you maximise your chances of getting into flow.
But in the environment we've created, Professor Joel Nichols, an attentional pathogenic environment, one that's damaging the attention of all of us, it's very hard to get into flow, which is why we have to take both the dozens of individual steps that I write about in Stone Focus and these bigger collective steps to take on the forces that are doing this to us.
Well, let's talk about the individual steps as an entry to talking about their limits and why your person is also social action.
You've got to experiment with most of the things that circulated on those tip lists, including every month. Complete digital detox. What did you learn from disconnecting from the internet for 90 days?
Oh God, I learned so much. I went to a place called Provincetown, Cape Coast, I was really lucky because the film rights for one of my books had sold, so I had a bit of money. And I was just tired of being wired, I couldn't take it anymore. So I announced to everyone triumphantly that I was going away for 3 months, I would have no laptop that could get online, and I have no smartphone. And so I went to Provincetown, which for people who don't know, if you want to picture Provincetown, it's in Cape Cod. It's the kind of place where more than one person makes a full-time living by dressing as Ursula, the villain from The Little Mermaid, and singing songs about sex, I'm sure I can't say on the air.
It's a great place.
And it was fascinating because there were some ups and downs, but what amazed me was how much my attention came back. I thought, like you said at the start, I've just gotten older, maybe my brain's just deteriorated. My attention went back to being as good as it is when I was 17. I could read books for 8-10 hours a day. It blew my mind. I later learned there were actually many things that had changed from this town, not just the absence of the tech that had done that to me. I completely changed the way I ate in Provincetown. Diets were really damaging my ability to focus. I was sleeping much more. I was much less stressed.
And I remember At the end of those three months, I'm never going to go back to the way that I did before. The joys of focus and attention are so amazing. And then I got my phone back, and within a month, I was 80% back to where I'd been.
And I only really understood why when I went to Moscow to interview someone called Dr. James Williams, who had been at the heart of Google. was horrified by what they were doing, quit, and became, I would argue, the leading philosopher of attention in the world. And he said to me, the mistake you've made there, Johan, is it's like you thought the solution to air pollution is for you personally to wear a gas mask.
I'm not against gas masks.
If I lived in Beijing, I'd wear a gas mask. But a gas mask isn't the solution to air pollution, right? It's just individually protecting yourself a little bit for a short time. And in the same way, being invaded by these deep forces, and while there are things we can do to stress stress, I'm really passionately in favour. There are a lot of things that I didn't integrate from my experience. I'm stupidly pointing at the screen, but this is the radio, so I can't see. At the corner of the room over there, I've got something called a K-safe. It's a plastic safe.
You take the lid, you put it in your phone, you turn the dial, and it locks your phone away for anything between five minutes and a whole day.
I use the phone four hours a day.
I will not sit down to watch a movie with my boyfriend unless we both put our phones in the K-safe.
I won't have dinner with my friends unless we all put our phones in the K-safe. And it's really difficult at first. But as you get your focus back, as you begin to be able to think deeply and clearly again, The effect is extraordinary, but I'm also conscious, and I think it's perhaps the thing about the collective element, I'm conscious that a lot of people will hear me saying, well, I put my phone away 4 hours a day and lock it away and go, well, Jesus, I can't do that, right?
And there's a place that I think built part of the solution to this.
In France, in 2018, they were having a huge crisis of what they called burnout, which I don't think I need to translate. And the French government, under pressure from labour unions, set up a commission to figure out why everyone is getting so burned out. And one of the things they discovered is that 35% of French workers felt they could never put their phone on silent or stop checking their email. Because their boss could message them at any time of the day or night, and if they didn't answer, they'd be in trouble.
I remember when we were kids, The only people who were on call were the president and doctors.
And even doctors went on call all the time, right?
We've now gone to a point where almost half the economy is on call all the time. And I can give people in that position all the lovely, sweet self-help lectures I like about the benefits of sleep and hugging and all the wonderful things about mind wandering.
And to them, that's not going to be some lovely relief. That's going to be a cruel torment because they can't do that.
So this is why the French government, I guess stressed under pressure from labour unions, they wouldn't have done it, they haven't been pressured, introduced a new law.
It's very simple, the law is called the right to disconnect. And it gives every French worker two rights. The first right is everyone has legally defined work hours in their contract. And secondly, everyone has the right to not check their phone. Or answer their email outside those work hours. So I went to Paris before the plague began and talked to people about this.
You know, when I was there, Rentokil, the pest control company, was fined 70,000 euros for trying to get one of their workers to answer his phone an hour after his work hours ended.
And you can see how that's a collective change that frees people up to make individual changes that they want to make in their lives.
And there are many changes like that that I describe in Style of Focus that we can fight for.
Johan Hari's new book is Stolen Focus, Why You Can't Pay Attention and How to Think Deeply Again. I'm going to take just 90 seconds before we go back to the interview to ask for your help with our fundraising efforts here. What if your fellow listeners are Celia in Santa Rosa? Put up a $1,000 challenge for this hour. We are now 10 minutes into the challenge and have raised only $100. Less than 19 minutes to go to raise the rest. And we are asking for your help. 1-800-439-5732 or save us a phone call and pledge at www.kpfa.org.
Any amount you pledge will help.
If you can pledge $15 a month or $150 all at once, we would love to give you a copy of the brand new book. It's fresh enough that you'll be helping Johan with the bestseller list. Stolen Focus, Why You Can't Pay Attention and How to Think Deeply Again. It is both a political journey. Into the companies and social arrangements that are so damaging to our collective ability to focus. And a very personal exploration of what happens when we try to take individual steps to deal with it. You can make some progress, but a lot of it has to be collective.
But he will tell you what worked for him. It's all in the book. It's yours for a pledge of 15 bucks a month or 150 all at once.
And if you do it right now, that pledge will go further towards helping KPFA out. We're now at 18 minutes left on the challenge, and I am out of time.
$900 to go. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800
Hey KPFA or kpfa.org. Back to the interview with Johan Hari.
I delved into an area of research that was surprising to me about the effects that the kind of deep breathing we do when we pry away ourselves away from distractions, about the effects that has on our other mental capacities. Spending a lot of time immersed in fiction, for instance, can make you better capable of understanding the mental states of other people.
One of the really big changes that's happened is the collapse of the reading of books. So now, for the first time in the history of the American Republic, the majority of Americans don't read a single book in an average year. 57% of Americans don't read a single book in an average year. And there's all sorts of problems with that. It's partly a symptom of the attention crisis, and it's partly a cause of it.
When you read books, it trains you to think in a deep, linear, and slow way.
And that's becoming harder for all of us. One thing that particularly collapses the reading of fiction, and I spent a lot of time interviewing amazing guy named Professor Ray Maher at the University of Toronto, who was the first scientist to prove, I think, persuasively, although some people disagree, I think is research persuasive, that when you read fiction, what you're doing is you're imagining what it's like to be another person. You're imagining yourself into the head of another person. It's actually much more effective than what we call virtual reality. And the novels are, in effect, a kind of empathy gym.
And when you read a novel and you put it down, what he showed is you're actually better at imagining what it's like to be other people because you practiced it, you're better at empathizing with other people,
and you compare that, I thought a lot when I was in Provincetown on the internet.
About this phrase I've never really understood before.
The Canadian philosopher Marshall McLuhan used this phrase, the medium is the message. And I never really knew what he meant when I read it in Provincetown. And what McLuhan was saying is when a new technology is invented, we often think it's a bit like a pipe. Information is poured in at one end and it just gets into our head at the other end. But actually, a new technology, he was thinking about television, is more like putting on a new set of goggles. And you start to see the world through those goggles, right? So you think about every time a new technology is invented, there's an implicit message in that technology about how the world should be.
So think about Twitter. What's the message hidden in Twitter?
Doesn't matter whether you're Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, or Bubba the Love Sponge.
When you tweet, what you're implicitly absorbing is a whole set of messages. Firstly, that the world should be understood very quickly. What matters is reacting very fast. Secondly, that the world can and should be described in 280 characters first, right?
In fact, the world can be described very simply, quickly, and simply.
And thirdly, what matters is whether people immediately agree with the very short, fast, and simplistic thing you just said. And I realized, when I thought about that, one of the reasons why I feel so bad when I use Twitter, even when I'm sort of winning, in inverted commas, when I'm getting all the retweets and everything, why I feel so bad, I don't think any of those messages are immediately true. I don't think you should respond to life very quickly. Usually your fastest responses are your least interesting. I don't think the world should be described in 280 characters. I once saw someone on television say, tweet us your thoughts about the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Yeah, don't tweet us your thoughts about the Israel-Palestine conflict. If your thoughts about the Israel-Palestine can be contained in 280 characters,
they're not worth hearing.
And thirdly, it really doesn't matter whether people immediately agree with you. In fact, everyone we all admire,
When they started to articulate their truths, most people disagreed with them.
But compare the message in the printed book, right? It doesn't matter what the specific book is. What is the message in the medium of the book?
Well, one of the messages is slow down.
Just think about one thing for 10 hours.
Just one thing.
Secondly, imagine what it's like to be another person.
Imagine what it's like to be inside the mind of another human being.
Right, and to me, those messages encourage the best in our nature.
They're at some level morally true.
And so the move away from books and other forms of deep focus, deep conversation, eye contact, a lot of the change happening towards these speedier, shallower, not against these things all the time, times when speed and shallowness are great fun.
And just like a one-night stand can be great fun, but you want to have relationships, right?
And a life built entirely around one-night stands would not be a fulfilling life in the end.
A life of such extreme speed, particularly the last quarter of my book's Don't Focus, about what this is doing to our children.
We particularly see this.
You know, when you see a child who can't focus and pay attention,
and there's been a huge increase in this problem,
you really see that is a child that's going to have a diminished life.
I want to go back to your life. I mean, you write books, you work in that medium, you also have to promote your books, and you have big followings on several social platforms, and I'm sure your publisher would be very angry with you if you did not take them to promote your books.
Like, how do you personally think about navigating between the recognition that the platforms are harmful and then the people you need to reach are on them.
You know, Brian, this is something I wrestle with all the time. It seems absolutely ridiculous to pop up on Twitter going, Hey everyone, read my book about why you can't pay attention.
The truth is, I literally never log into any of these things. I'm in the ridiculous position that I have an assistant, so I tell her what I want my tweets to be. I tell her what I want my Facebook updates to be, but I never log in and I never look at it. I mean, she tells me things she thinks I know, so I get some information from it. But I'm going to interject that the last time we spent physical time together, you dropped me a direct message on Twitter to ask if I was around.
I get, yeah, I sent my director messages as well, because for me, this is the thing, if you think about it through just personal willpower, the truth is, you know, I had a real epiphany about this. One of the first interviews I did at the book, I went to interview a man named Roy Baumeister, who's the leading expert on willpower in the whole world, a book called Willpower. People who know, and a lot of people listening will have heard of him called the Marshmallow Test.
He's the psychologist who invented that, right? I went to interview him and I said,
You know, I'm thinking about a book about why people struggle to focus and pay attention, just really keen on your insights. He said,
It's interesting you say that, because I've just found I can't really pay attention very much now. I play video games on my phone a lot.
I was like, wait, didn't you write a book called Willpower?
Aren't you the leading expert on willpower?
And you're telling me you play Candy Crush all the time.
It was like the moment at the end of that movie, the invasion of the body snatchers, where the person realised everyone's body snatched.
And it really helped me to realise that just personal willpower ain't going to do it, right?
It can help.
I mean, the case, that's a form of the safe space to lock away my phone.
That's a form of willpower.
But personal willpower on its own isn't going to get us very far.
So this is something I definitely wrestle with.
I live in this intentional pathogenic environment like everyone else.
I am definitely not a paragon of detention.
Some of the things that I learned,
for example, we need to eat really differently if we want to get our attention back.
And literally on the other side of my laptop, to which I'm talking to you, there's a KFC bucket.
I struggle with these things like everyone else.
It's hard, and it feels particularly ridiculous to be promoting a book on social media that warns about social media.
It's very hard, and we're in an illustration of a much wider phenomenon that we live in an environment that is constantly pushing us towards things that are bad for our attention, whether it's pushing us to stay awake, we don't sleep, our kids don't sleep, and then the next day we're much vulnerable, tech that is causing us to struggle, your mind wakefully, and you're half asleep, whether it's food-induced constant pushing us to eat food that causes massive energy spikes and crashes, which keep brain fog throughout the day.
We live in an environment that is doing this to us, and you can't protect yourself to a certain degree, and I'm sure people are doing that.
But the real solution is we've got to change the environment.
The voice of Johann Hari, his new book is Stolen Focus. It is one and only feature-thinking gift for today, for offering a pledge of $15 a month or $150 all at once, if you can get in by the end of the hour and help us out with our $1,000 challenge at 1-800-439-5732. Or www.kkfa.org.
It's an incredible journey through the attention wars.
There is a really high-stakes battle playing out in the tech world over how to monopolize as much of your attention as possible in your waking hours, and the boundaries of that are literally how to get you to stay awake longer, how to get you to pay attention to two devices at once, and how to get you to never leave something once you have logged into it.
There are legions of engineers and behavioral scientists and designers working on making every small improvement they can to metrics that basically constitute an assault on your attention span.
And he is incredibly good at walking you through the business decisions, the scientific research on what impact they have on our psyche, what we know and what we are learning about the costs of multitasking, task switching is what we're actually doing. The cost of the collapse of reading as a pastime, the kind of deep reflection that it demands. The cost of having every piece of interstitial time eaten up by notifications and scrolling, and podcasts that we never free our minds to wander.
It takes you through practical steps that you can take to seize control of your own attention.
And he talks about the larger social stakes and what is fundamentally a political battle about what areas of life we allow to be subjugated to the imperatives of market capitalism.
It's an incredible book.
It's an important book.
If you've been listening to this thinking, wow, those problems, some of them describe me. I start staring at my phone when I want to be paying attention to the people I'm spending time with.
I have a hard time focusing on a book or a task for long enough to complete it. I can't get into that flow state I used to find so much joy in.
Well, one of the solutions is like sitting down with a book on paper. A book that does not have notifications popping up at the top of the frame that your eyes are paying attention to. And this book is a pretty good read. Johann Hari's Stolen Focus is yours for a pledge of $150 or more. It's $15 a month. At 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or online at kpfa.org. If you make a pledge right now, it will count towards a $1,000 challenge that one of your fellow listeners has put up. We are currently $400 away from making it. And as a freebie, as an extra bonus for everyone who pledges any amount, we are throwing in an archival recording from KPFA's vault that we made in 1993 of the departed Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh giving a 90-minute lecture at the Berkeley Community Theater. Talk about someone who is able to engage with the political aspects of sustained attention and contemplation. So you'll get 90 minutes with Thich Nhat Hanh, you'll get an entire book by Johann Hari, and you'll get KPFA for your entire life, we hope. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or online at www.kpfa.org. We're now in our final three minutes, and we are at $300 left to raise if we want to make that $1,000 challenge. Shout out to Raul, who pledged from Reedley, so I wish you guys good luck. Gail, who pledged from El Cerrito, and Jeffrey, who pledged from Nevada City, as well as those donors who asked not to be named on air. 1-800-439-5732, and Jacob, who just pledged in San Francisco. We're now at $150 left to raise. That means... One person making a $150 pledge can get the book, can get the Thich Nhat Hanh lecture, and can bring in an extra $1,000 for the community radio station that we all collectively cherish. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And I hope the conversation we're having makes you mindful of what's great about KPFA. We're not constantly interrupting what you're listening to for commercial breaks. So we are not constantly hitting you with zings and teases and coming up and hooks to try to stay tuned in through those commercial breaks. I mean, what's really happening in the commercial broadcast media is a non-stop war for your attention that is getting ever more fraught as ever more sophisticated tech companies start competing for the same attention span. If you value having immediate media where ideas have time to be developed, to be elaborated, to be challenged, and to be fleshed out, if you took it to heart when Johann Hari said no opinion about the Israel-Palestinian conflict is worth expressing in 280 characters, if it can be expressed in 280 characters, then I hope you appreciate the kind of discussions that you get over the course of a full hour at KPFF. Any amount will count towards the challenge. We have to raise a total of 150 in the next 30 seconds if we're going to make it. If you can do 150 all at once, we can give you Johann Hari's book, Stolen Focus, Why You Can't Pay Attention, and How to Think Deeply Again. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or online at www.kpfa.org. We're going to go out on a cliffhanger. The tally hasn't moved up yet. They will keep counting pledges for the first minute of the next hour. Stay tuned.
Book banning is happening in school boards and local elections across America. KPFA believes we are poorer as a nation with these omissions. Books about slavery, social justice, survival are defining characteristics of the American experiment. KPFA has collected five extraordinary banned books in our newly designed banned book bag. During this fun drive, tell the world I read banned books. Available now at kpfa.org. Thank you.
Hi, David Talbot, author of Susan the Witch and the Devil's Chessboard. In these days when news and culture are so formatted and corporatized,
I rely on KPFA more and more. Shows like Flashpoint, Project Sensor, Democracy Now, and For Fun, Rich and Tyranny Now. They keep me going, and I know they keep you going too. So please join me in supporting KPFA. It's an essential community resource. Thank you.
Hi, this is Nomi Prince. As everyone knows, we live in a world that gets harder and harder each day to wait, gaming an endless stream of lives. That's why now more than ever, crucial for brave media like KPFA to thrive. Public radio serves the public, period. So please consider donating whatever you can today to help KPFA remain a beacon of truth.
Donate today by calling 1-800-439-5732 or online at kpfa.org.
You're listening to 94.1 FM KPFA and KPFB 89.3 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, and K24 FM in Santa Cruz, and online all the time at kpfa.org. Coming up next, Against the Grain with Sasha Little and CS Song. But first, the news.
If it appears that COVID-19 symptoms like cough, fever, sore throat, and loss of taste and smell are beginning to present themselves, you can begin to self-isolate and take a rapid test at home. After getting your test results, you can learn more about proper self-isolation guidelines by visiting quebec.ca/self-isolating. This information is there to help protect you and everyone living under the same roof. All of us can make a difference. So let's keep making sure all of us are safe. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
This program contains strong language and some situation discretion is advised.
All the way live radio, CKT 90.3 FM, every single Wednesday, 3 to 5. This is Pro V. Today's show is going to be a Sean J. Period mix. For those who don't know Sean J. Period, he's a producer out of Virginia who worked with a lot of people. He worked with Artifacts, Blackstar.